Hello everybody and welcome back to another week here at the Damage Report. It's already shaping up to be a big week in the news for some good reasons and some tragic reasons. We're gonna be covering the entire gamut over the course of today's episode. In just a little bit, Jason Carter is gonna be in the studio to break down last night's Grammys ceremony. It was a pretty big one, and so we're gonna cover all the angles on that. We've got Nina Turner of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. She's gonna be joining us a little bit later on to give us an update on what's going on in North Carolina, but also to react to the massive surge in the polls that Bernie Sanders has been experiencing in the run up to Iowa and New Hampshire, which is a pretty important time to be moving up in the polls. And then later on, we're gonna be closing out the show. Rick Strom of TYT Sports is gonna be joining us in studio to break down the tragic passing of Kobe Bryant, his daughter, and seven other individuals in a tragic helicopter crash yesterday in this area, actually. So lots to get to, obviously. We wanna jump right into it though with the big news concerning impeachment. All I live for is the rare opportunity for a book to change the world, and we've got one of those opportunities today. Unfortunately, it's John Bolton's book. It's not what I would have picked initially, but it's got some big allegations about Donald Trump, Ukraine, and quid pro quos, and it might change the course of this impeachment trial in the Senate. So let me give you the details. In the manuscript for this upcoming book, because it's obviously not out yet, which Bolton circulated to White House officials as part of a standard pre-publication review process, Bolton described the private conversation he had with the president in August about Ukraine. Trump told Bolton that, quote, he wanted to continue freezing $391 million in security assistance to Ukraine until officials there helped with investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens. Now, you have probably heard effectively that stated over and over and over again. It is abundantly clear that that is exactly what was going on. But here is John Bolton, a man who was in a position of power and physically in a position to know that Donald Trump was making that very explicit, a direct connection between those two things. You don't get the aid until you investigate my political rivals. And so it's really important to hear what he has to say, to hear more about what these conversations were that he was having with Donald Trump, which means we have some more pressure for witnesses, but it does not mean that we will actually get them. Now, I wanna jump ahead to Donald Trump responding to this big revelation. He tweeted, I never told John Bolton that the aid to Ukraine was tied to investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens. In fact, he never complained about this at the time of his very public termination. If John Bolton said this, it was only to sell a book. So first of all, let me just briefly note, he has to throw in his very public termination, which because he's such a bizarre weirdo sociopath, he thinks the fact that every time he fires someone, he makes a big public to-do about it, like on social media, he thinks that reflects poorly on those other people rather than on him. He can't even do an impersonation of an actual human being. But anyway, so he apparently didn't complain about this when he was fired. Okay, I guess he could have brought it up. You would have denied it at that time too. And look, the concern about he just wants to sell some books, I will say this. He definitely wants to sell some books, definitely. But that by itself does not mean that what he is alleging in the book did not actually happen. And if we're gonna get into who can we trust, who can we not, I will admit, I am predisposed to not believe what John Bolton says. Here though, he is confirming what many different people have attested to over the course of the past few months. Now, it would have been great to hear him say this in the House during the investigation back over the past few months. We didn't get that. Now, if you listen to Donald Trump, and again, this goes to credibility, he tweeted today, the Democrat-controlled House never even asked John Bolton to testify. It is up to them, not up to the Senate. So here's the thing, it's just not true. If you jump back to October 30th, here was a headline, House Democrats asked John Bolton to testify in Trump impeachment probe on November 7th. Now that didn't happen because John Bolton refused at that point to testify, but they certainly wanted him to do so. That has been a pretty consistent position for literally months now. Now this is the most important part of it. Will we get John Bolton in person to testify to this? And we're gonna dive into that in just a little bit. Some of the reaction from the right as to whether that should actually happen. But first, this was not the only thing that was revealed in his manuscript. There were a few other things of note. For example, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledged privately that there was no basis to claims by the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, that the ambassador to Ukraine was corrupt and believed Mr. Giuliani may have been acting on behalf of other clients. Now, That's a claim about what Mike Pompeo apparently said in private. I expect that he similarly will deny that it happened. But look, I mean, even us, you know, totally on the outside, we can look at this and we know this was Giuliani, Parnas, and Fruman for a couple of years acting behind the scenes to get Marie Yovanovitch, you know, ushered out of there. And they were willing to say whatever they had to do to get that to actually happen. Now, Mike Pompeo, he's actually working in the Department of State. Like he, if there was a reason to suspect that she was disloyal or was, you know, actively undermining diplomatic efforts in Ukraine, he would probably have raised that himself. It's clear that this was a shadow campaign operating outside of official diplomatic channels, and he apparently, at least in private, acknowledged that. We do have one other person that might get tied in here when we're talking about witnesses. This is again from the upcoming manuscript. And the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, was present for at least one phone call where the president and Mr. Giuliani discussed the ambassador, Mr. Bolton wrote. Mr. Mulvaney has told associates he would always step away when the president spoke with his lawyer to protect their attorney-client privilege. But apparently, at least in one case, that did not actually happen. And the reason that is important is we have Bolton, we have Pompeo, we have Mulvaney. These are all three individuals with firsthand information about what was going on. Obviously, we need to hear from all of them. The only reason we haven't heard from any of the three is because Donald Trump and the White House are blocking that from actually happening. There now is a statement by John Bolton. There is Donald Trump stating that it is not true. Because of how important this entire process is, the fate of a presidency could be on the line. We can't allow that to go unadjudicated, which means we have to now hear from them. John Bolton needs to come in. He needs to be under oath. He needs to be questioned. And if Donald Trump believes that we can't trust what he says, then Donald Trump too can take the stand. He can go under oath and he can you know, make counterclaims to what John Bolton is saying. It is well within both of their rights to do that. But I have a feeling that Donald Trump will maintain his current obstruction of any new evidence, any new witnesses, even though virtually everyone at the highest levels of the Trump administration have now been implicated in this story and the people desperately need to know what is actually going on. Now, with that said, let's jump just briefly to some of what the right is saying. What are they saying in right-wing media? What are some of the Republican politicians saying? So we now know John Bolton is claiming in his upcoming book that Donald Trump explicitly set out a quid pro quo with Ukraine over military aid and investigations of the Bidens. And so you know what time it is in American politics. It's time for these sorts of headlines. Report, GOP senators shaken by Bolton allegations of Trump-Ukraine scheme. Now look, maybe, fingers crossed, maybe this is the time when them being shaken behind the scenes actually represents something. But we have heard them be shaken a whole bunch of times over the past few years, and it very rarely has amounted to much of anything. To give an example of what I mean, reporter Haley Byrd, she was on the Hill today. And so she asked Republican Senator Josh Hawley, why wouldn't the Senate want to hear from a firsthand witness like John Bolton? And very serious Senator Josh Hawley responded, well, I don't know. Is he a firsthand witness? I'm not sure. What does firsthand witness mean if not the person who had a conversation with Donald Trump about this? Like at this point, is Donald Trump a firsthand witness? Like they've been crowing month after month, we want to hear from people that were actually in the room. John Bolton, what name so? Keep him out of the city. We don't want him anywhere near a camera during this trial. And that's the thing, they're shaken. Maybe it's inconvenient, I guess. It looks bad for them. It's a reminder that they've sold their souls to Donald Trump and his cult. But are they shaken enough to actually vote based on it? Kind of doubt it. Now, Susan Collins says that this new revelation has bolstered the case for witnesses. I've heard her be frustrated with stuff before. Again, until they've actually voted against the interests of Donald Trump and the Republican Party, I will believe it when I see it. Now, supposedly behind the scenes, there is at least some pushback against Trump in the White House. Maggie Haberman tweeted, per sources, some GOP senators privately pushing White House for information on who administration had visibility into the manuscript over the last month. Senators feel blindsided. Oh, do you? Oh, Republican senators, were you surprised to find out that in the end, they knew that this was coming, but they didn't tell you because they didn't care what happened to you? Are you shocked that you were betrayed by Donald Trump after showing great loyalty to him? Have they been paying attention to this process? It's like someone in the sixth season watching Game of Thrones is like, oh my God, he just killed my favorite character. How could he? Do you know anything about this? That's what he does. He turns on you. He doesn't care about you. He's protecting himself. I cannot believe that they are feeling blindsided remotely at this point. But anyway, I mean, look, that's the Republican politicians. Let's turn briefly to how is the right-wing media going to address this. Here is a bit of Fox and Friends having now discovered what John Bolton knows.
They said that John Bolton has been distributing copies to any or all, to everyone. They said we did not. They said the Times reporting there says they shared the manuscript with others is false. They say they did it through the process, and the process obviously is corrupt. So if John Bolton's lawyers are telling the truth here, and they just submitted it in, and it's leaked out, if that is indeed the case, more evidence that people within the administration are actually against the administration. And the other thing is, devastating timing, because this thing was on the fast track to closing out without witnesses on Friday. Right. Only Mitt Romney pretty much saying, I want to see witnesses. Everybody else saying, I've heard enough. And now this gives fuel to the Senator Schumer's of the world, the Adam Schiff's of the world, to say, I need a witness, and he wants to testify.
But when you say devastating timing, it's got to be a coincidence, right? That it would come out just hours before the Senate impeachment is going to start at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Is it a coincidence? No, obviously it's not a coincidence. Obviously he wants to sell books. But again, that does not mean that what he's saying is not true. And when Brian Kilmeade, he had like a quarter of a thought there, which is still a record for him. But when he says this is devastating, that it throws fuel to those who are saying we need witnesses. Okay, why does it do that? Because this is a person who was in those rooms, knew Donald Trump, was involved in all of this, and is saying something that is incredibly damning to the case that Donald Trump has laid out. That's why. Not just because it's inconvenient, not just because there's one team and there's another team. I'm on this team. I don't like when something works for them. Let's get to the substance of what actually happened. It is devastating because people are going to want to know what John Bolton actually knows, and they want him under oath when they're saying that. Complete the actual thought. Go beyond partisanship and tribalism and talk about what is actually at stake here. And just briefly, in terms of what's at stake, if there's any remaining credibility for Fox and Friends, take a look at Steve Doocy right there. He has no interest in what is now being described as a 100% clear quid pro quo. Let's go to Steve Doocy a couple months ago and Steve Doocy today.
Because if the president said, you know, I'll give you the money, but you got to investigate Joe Biden, that is really off the rails wrong. Apparently it says Bolton was told Trump wanted to continue freezing money to Ukraine until they helped with probes of the Bidens. But we heard him say in the transcript he wanted President Zelensky to look into the Bidens and what happened in 2016. So is this a big story?
Maybe it's off the rails wrong. Maybe something can go off the rails, but after a couple of months it can go back on the rails. I don't know. I love that, like, the 100% clear identifiable hypocrisy matters. Not at all. And now they've turned to, I'm not gonna go through all the tweets, they're all attacking John Bolton. They loved him a little bit ago, but now he's the worst person in the world. In fact, even Brian Kilmeade, is according to Matthew Gaetz, he says the president, quote, has to do a better job vetting his staff. Bolton worked for Fox News for like a decade. Okay, so who needs to do better vetting? You had no problem with him when he was pushing for war on Fox News literally every single day. But now he's working against the interests of Donald Trump, and so suddenly he's a big issue. Okay, well, I would love to hear what he has to say. Hopefully we will see witnesses, although I'm not holding my breath. Okay, stick around, lots more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Last night was the 62nd annual Grammy Awards, and for fairly obvious reasons, it was a more somber occasion than usual. But we do want to break down some of the big highlights of the night. So joining us now to do that is Jason Carter, entertainment journalist, host, and producer.
John,
welcome to the studio.
Yeah, great to be back, man. The 62nd annual Grammys last night were, as you said, definitely there was a somber tone, of course. You know, the death of Kobe Bryant, his daughter, as well as six other people, in addition to allegations that came to fruition last week from ousted CEO Deborah Dugan, who was the first female CEO in the 62-year inception of the Grammys, calling to light favoritism, it being a boys' club, sexual misconduct, and things of those nature. So all eyes were on the award show last night, which I thought went off without a hitch. Alicia Keys returning as the host, who I thought was the perfect person to handle the tone of the room. You know, it was just, you couldn't deny that celebrities were in their feelings last night, and rightfully so.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to read a bit of what she said.
Sure.
We would play the video, but they would nuke our studio from orbit if we played any of their videos.
So it's YouTube for you.
Here's what Alicia Keys said. She said, "Here we are together on music's biggest night, celebrating the artists that do it best. But to be honest with you, we're all feeling crazy sadness right now. Because earlier today, Los Angeles, America, and the whole wide world lost a hero. And we're literally standing here heartbroken in the house that Kobe Bryant built." And I mean,
nail on the head, absolutely. And you know, people as well as Chrissy Teigen tweeted that they felt, celebrities felt guilty
doing it at all.
Because really, did any of it matter if you think about it?
It feels a little bit silly in the immediate aftermath, even though, of course, it's recognition of a great amount of work and all that. You know, just briefly, I know we're not gonna focus on the scandal too much, but it does seem like, so you talked about she was talking about how it's a boys' club, there's favoritism. The specific allegations, when you read about them, it feels like it goes way beyond favoritism. It seems like she was basically identifying that the way that they pick nominees, at least in some categories, is fundamentally unlike anything a regular person would think is going on.
Sure.
And far more corrupt than some of the other awards shows.
Well, closed room meetings with people on the committee, with artists who are closely tied to people on these committees that make these decisions. So, and she was deeply ingrained in the Academy, so she would be privy to those types of behaviors. She went on all four networks last week saying she has written proof and persons who would corroborate her allegations against the Academy, which of course has vehemently denied all allegations made against them. So it could definitely shroud what went on last night. But let's talk about the music, because that's what the Grammys is. It's music's biggest night. We had Billie Eilish, who swept.
She won everything?
All four coveted categories: Song of the Year, Record of the Year, Best New Artist, and Album of the Year.
And Best Picture somehow. I don't know how, but she did it. Yeah, so this was the, she was the first woman ever to do this.
Yes.
And the youngest person
to do this, right?
Yes.
Which in 2019, of course, Billie Eilish was an inescapable movement in music. Lizzo was the most nominated with 8 nominations, only winning 3 in the categories of Pop Solo Performance, Urban Contemporary Album, which in the past people like Beyonce have won. Which questions why is the Academy, which Deborah Dugan has said, only allowing non-persons of color to win in these categories, or of the coveted, right? Lizzo also won traditional R&B performance, which I thought Lizzo was going to sweep. Again, another movement in 2019 for music. You couldn't go anywhere without hearing Good as Hell or Truth Hurts or Jerome from Lizzo. She ushered in a whole conversation of inclusivity, body positivity, and was antithetical to what a pop star is in music. So it was a shock for a lot of people.
Look, the thing is, if you say it's inescapable, like you couldn't miss some of these things, if anyone could, it's me. I don't pay attention to anything. And yet, like, I came across Lizzo everywhere.
Right.
And so, like, Does it feel like it was a night of snubs?
Well, when you talk about snubs, one person...
Is it the Oscars, but in advance?
It could be. And, you know, Ariana Grande nominated for multiple awards last night, nominated for 5, didn't win a one. Interestingly enough, last year she won her first Grammy for Sweetener, but...
She's only won one. Is she the Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yes. Performed
she
last night.
She needs a bear in one of her music videos, I think.
Performed last night, but didn't win. And, you know, when you do cutaways in the award show, they try to get the artist who did not win's reaction. They had one from Ariana Grande that screamed, yikes. But I do think that she should have been awarded more because, listen, she dropped 2 albums in a 6-month period over the course of a year, right? Sweetener and Thank You Next. Again, we talk about Inescapable John. You could not go anywhere without hearing 7 Rings, Thank You Next, or anything from that album, which was a fantastic body of work. So a snub, most definitely, nothing from Ed Sheeran. Lil Nas X was a movement as well. Old Town Road, come on, right?
So I know that there was some, yeah, I mean, again, I heard it a million times. And I admit, as a person who does not much care for music or care about music, Pretty catchy. Well, and also it was like number one for longer than any song ever. Right.
Broke records in 2019. Yeah. And also his story coming out LGBTQ+, leaning into that, being a beacon and a vision for Gen Z, younger millennials to see what representation looks like in a genre of music, which is rap, if you will. Because I kind of felt like Old Town Road was kind of a parody song. But anyways, rap that has been historically littered with homophobia and misogynistic tones. So for him to not really have a showing last night too, that was also kind of shocking, indicative of where the Academy should go when it comes to inclusivity. I mean, Alicia Keys, hello. This is someone who has 15 Grammys, has won every category, has hosted the event, is in bed with the Academy, with a gentle hand calling them out in her opening speech.
Yeah.
Something needs to change, John.
Well, and also, so I'm gonna refer to him as Puff Daddy because the last time I actively listened to music, that's what he was called. He also brought it up too, right? On the stage.
Yes.
And so, like, is the Billie Eilish Lizzo thing, is that all the proof that you need that this is another awards ceremony that, like, says it's moving in the right direction, and yet if there's progress, it's glacial?
That's a great question, and I think that it all depends on who's watching. I will say personally for myself, I thought that this year's nominees were young. There were women of color. There were people of color. There were women. So I think the Academy gets it. I don't work for the Academy. I'm not too sure how they do things. But if what Deborah Dugan is saying is accurate, there definitely needs to be change. And also, people like Kanye West and Beyonce, who have never won Album of the Year, have had tremendous bodies of work, right? So when it comes to, are we really leaning into what the public wants? Is the music good? Yes, the music is good. Should we give the award to people who deserve it? Yes. And I think the Academy needs to listen more to what the public wants versus their own self-interest. The AMAs, the BBAs, those are all kind of popularity contest award shows. But the people who win are deserving. Taylor Swift. Oh my gosh. Great bodies of work. Great career. Has given us hit after hit after hit, which are good. She's winning the awards, rightfully so. So Grammys, take note.
Yeah. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad
I know we're going to be talking about the Oscars very soon.
Yes.
Which I guarantee I have a little bit more knowledge in that area. I've been actively watching as many of the Best Picture nominees as I can. So thank you.
Yeah.
Great to have you on and look forward to talking to you in the near future.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Everybody at home, stick around. Lots more right after this. Appreciate a good public breakdown as much as I do. Take a look at what happened with Mike Pompeo after an interview with an NPR reporter, which you don't normally think of as being the font of much drama, but this one is. So NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly had an interview with Mike Pompeo back on January 24th. It became heated when she asked him about the ongoing Ukraine scandal and impeachment, to which he replied that he'd only come on to talk about Iran. Kelly answered that she had confirmed with his staff that she would discuss both Iran and Ukraine. So apparently he lost it. Kelly told her All Things Considered co-host Ari Shapiro on Friday that Pompeo, who had walked out of the interview only after, quote, he leaned in, glared at me, was waiting for her later in his private quarters. He shouted at me for about the same time as the 9-minute interview itself had lasted. He was not happy to have been asked about Ukraine. He asked, do you think Americans care about Ukraine? He used the F word in that sentence and many others. But look, that's ridiculous to blow up about that. She apparently asked if he feels like he owes an apology to Marie Yovanovitch, who was, the subject of stalking and, apparently a murder plot maybe. So tough question, but fair, considering that happened, and he has 100% taken the side of the people who were cooking up this plot rather than one of his employees who he should have been defending. It goes beyond just screaming at her, though. She says, he asked if I could find Ukraine on a map. I said yes. He called out for his aides to bring in a map of the world with no writing, no countries marked. I pointed to Ukraine. He put the map away. He said, people will hear about this. At that point, you should hope that people don't hear about this. First of all, why do you have a bizarrely unlabeled map of the world? Like, is he regularly quizzing people on geography? And then when she passes his ridiculous test, he storms out, much like he's a big fan of Donald Trump, who'd do the same thing. So look, that's ridiculous. It looks horrible. The Secretary of State shouting at this NPR reporter for daring to ask him about something that they had set up in advance that they were going to do. Then this weird geography test, which she does, and then he gets mad about that. Then he decides to make it public and puts out a statement. It says, NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly lied to me twice. First last month in setting up our interview, and then again yesterday in agreeing to have our post-interview conversation off the record. It is shameful that this reporter chose to violate the basic rules of journalism and decency. This is another example of how unhinged the media has become in its quest to hurt President Trump and this administration. It is no wonder that the American people distrust many in the media when they so consistently demonstrate their agenda and their absence of integrity. And then he closes by saying, it is worth noting that Bangladesh is not Ukraine. So what we're supposed to take from that is that NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly, she was given a map without any countries on it, asked to identify Ukraine, which notably is in the Euro region, and pointed to Bangladesh. Now that seems on its face a little bit ridiculous, but to give you an idea of how ridiculous it is, here's a tweet from Walter Schaub, who has a map. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away. So sort of absurd that she would do that, particularly when you find out that she has a master's degree in European studies from Cambridge, which she got after studying at Harvard University. I have a feeling she didn't point at Bangladesh. How bizarre a claim to make about her while working for a man who, if you asked him to point out on a map where Ukraine is, he might miss the table, Donald Trump. So anyway, also by the way, the claims he made about her lying, totally not true. She provided the receipts. So here's a back and forth that she had with Pompeo press aide Katie Martin. Katie Martin wrote, this is before the interview, just wanted to touch base that we still intend to keep the interview to Iran tomorrow. No, you just got back from Tehran, so we would like to stick to Iran as the topic as opposed to jumping around. Is that something we can agree to? To which she responded, I am indeed just back from Tehran and plan to start there. Also Ukraine. And who knows what the nudes gods will serve up overnight. I never agree to take anything off the table, which they read as, sure, just Iran. Except that that's not the case, and they have the paper trail to prove it. So the whole thing looks horrible for the State Department there. So is there any way that it could actually get worse? It could. People on the right, so frustrated with Mike Pompeo getting triggered over a simple question about his duties as the Secretary of State, led to people like Mark Levin tweeting, why does NPR still exist? To which Donald Trump, the President of the United States, responded, a very good question. So when an NPR reporter asks Mike Pompeo some simple questions that are totally within his area of expertise and knowledge, after saying in advance that that's what they were going to be talking about, the response is, she's a big old liar and we're going to destroy NPR. Or at the very least, we're thinking about that as a possibility. If you had forgotten recently, with all this focus on corruption and election interference, how inherently opposed to the free media this administration is, this should be an important wake-up call for you. Any tough questions, and they will question the legitimacy, the very existence of the media outlet itself. Now that is embarrassing. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. On the other side though, Nina Turner's gonna be joining us. Very excited for that. We are just a handful of days away from the first of these contests in the Democratic primary, and Senator Bernie Sanders has been moving up in the polls both nationally and in some of the early states. So this is just about the perfect time to bring onto the show once again Nina Turner, national co-chair for the Bernie 2020 campaign. Nina, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Now, before we get to the early states, you've been in one of the states that's going to be voting a little bit later on in North Carolina. What's going on in North Carolina?
Excitement. I mean, we were in Durham, Greensboro, and Charlotte. And I can tell you, from Friday through Sunday, hundreds of people came out to hear about the message and the vision of Senator Sanders. So from housing for all to talking about civil rights then and now, to talking about the Green New Deal and climate chaos and our respective responsibilities in working to turn all that around, folks in North Carolina are certainly feeling the burn and very excited about the senator, his candidacy, and our opportunities in 2020.
You know, I'm curious, right now, Bernie Sanders is one of a few candidates that can't be out campaigning. He's got to be in DC, he's got to be working on the impeachment, at least for the near future. So I'm assuming there's more pressure on high profile people like you in the campaign to sort of fill in. How does that affect the dynamics of the race that, some people, Pete Buttigieg, he's out on the campaign trail, but Bernie Sanders, he has to rely on his inner circle to sort of hold things together.
That's right, John, and that's where the me, not me, us comes in. That mantra, that foundation is what we live by in the Sanders campaign. And so the beautiful thing is that we have all along been dispatching people like myself, other of the national co-chairs like Representative Ro Khanna, Mayor Carmen Cruz, Ben Cohen, and other, as you said, national surrogates and grassroots surrogates as well, all along the way in the campaign. So it's not as though we have to start something new. We've been doing that all along because we know that the grassroots in this movement that surrounds the senator is really the wind beneath his wings. So it does mean I may travel a little more often, if that is even possible. I have three suitcases packed at all times, John. Maybe now I need four, but we are rolling strong. And as you laid out in North Carolina, for example, the senator was not there, but we were drawing hundreds of people to those events on weekend nights without the senator physically being there. What that means is that his movement is going to sustain him. And people like myself and others, we will complement all that the senator has been working for. So I am very excited to continue my journey across this country.
You know, sort of similarly, I saw that just a few days ago in Iowa City, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had a crowd of about 800 that Senator Sanders called into, but she was there in person. And I'm assuming she probably is having to take on a little bit more of the burden as well, at least until this impeachment inquiry is wrapped up.
Well, Phil Agnew was there as well. As you know, he gave a riveting speech that had people in tears and ended that speech with these hands as he had folks embrace one another, hold each other's hand, and relate to things that people go through on a regular basis. Michael Moore was there. So you're going to have a whole plethora of folks. As you know, in Iowa last week, we had Representative Jayapal, who has come out to endorse the senator. It was just absolutely a thing of beauty to have her there. As you know, she is the champion on Medicare for All in the House of Representatives. So it's going to be a lot of people, a lot of the senator's supporters, surrogates, both grassroots, because I don't want to lose sight, John, of the grassroots folks as well, who are champions in this campaign. I know we get caught up with the fancy titles, but there are people from all walks of life and all professions who are holding this campaign down on behalf of the senator.
Yeah. Now, as I alluded to in the intro, in both national and Iowa, New Hampshire, the polls, Bernie Sanders has been gaining. He has some fairly significant leads in Iowa, some of the most recent polls. At the same time, though, feel free to disagree. It feels to me like some of the powers that be in the Democratic Party, former people involved in the Hillary Clinton campaign back in 2016, they seem to feel a little bit more freed up, perhaps because he's been doing so on the polls, to launch a new set of attacks against Bernie Sanders. I've seen op-eds. Hillary Clinton had her big interview just a week ago. From the inside in the campaign, how does this new set of attacks against Bernie Sanders, how is that influencing the way that you're approaching these first contests?
We're staying on the issues as you know, and your viewers know, the senator, that's his thing. He does not policy, 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 issues, issues, issues. So nothing changes just because the neoliberals or the establishment want to try to attack this campaign. We are on the move and they know it. The most important thing here is that we stay focused on the issues. That contrast of records is very important as the American people decide who will be the champion for their causes, who is committed to changing the material conditions of the workaday people from all backgrounds in this country. That right there is fair game. This other stuff, these other games that they're playing in terms of trying to malign the senator's supporters, trying to malign him on issues that don't matter, it's just not going to work. As we see, not only through the polling, the senator's favorability ratings are high, his very favorable favorability ratings are high as well. People know him to be honest. They know him to be courageous. They know him to be consistent. And they know him to be the person who has said to Wall Street, I'm coming for your greed. Pharmaceutical industry, I'm coming for your greed. Fossil fuel industry, I'm coming for your greed. And he has also cautioned and encouraged, inspired the working class and barely middle class people of this country to believe that they deserve better than what they've gotten. So in short, John, we are going to keep our eyes on the prize, keep knocking on those doors, keep sending out those text messages, keep having conversations with people on the ground to drive out the vote and help people understand that their champion is Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I wanted to get your response to one particular sort of attack that really gets what you say that people feel like they know Bernie Sanders, they know his record. This new thing that I've heard very often is, he's got super high favorables, but the only reason is that he has never actually really been attacked. That him, his supporters, his positions, his past, they've never been critiqued. What do you make of that sort of narrative?
Give me a break. He ran in 2016. He's been vetted. You know, he went through this in 2016. He has been vetted. Again, it's just a cop out. And every time the senator gains or this movement gains, those elitists who don't want to see the change because they don't need it to change, they benefit from things staying just the way that they are. Those are the people that will move the goalposts. Now that the senator is doing, he's doing very well, for example, with women. You know, they can't use that misogynist, sexist excuse or trope anymore. He's doing very well with African Americans and Latinx folks and other people of color. So they can't use that anymore either. So they have to constantly come up with reasons to try to malign the senator, but it is not going to work. And John, in some cases, I hate to say, but I think some of these folks would rather see President Trump get a second term than to see President Bernie Sanders get the nomination. But the people ultimately of this country will have the final say. So if it is truly about electability, then Senator Sanders from 2016 to this very moment has been polling as the candidate to go head to head with President Trump and to defeat him. He is the progressive in this race, whereby President Trump can use the same talking points that he used in 2016. You know, he won, by example, 80 of the 88 counties in my home state because the trade deals that hurt the people in my state, states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. So he can't use that against Senator Sanders because he stood up against those wars, starting with Vietnam, Iraq, you know, standing up against trade deals that took away job opportunities for the working class people of this nation. So he, you know, when you juxtaposition a liar against somebody that's honest, juxtaposition somebody who's a faux populist against somebody who is a true progressive and has all of the receipts, because he has been on the streets decade after decade after decade, aligning himself and standing side by side with the very workers in this nation who need somebody to be a true champion. And when it comes to fundraising, John, we have data that really shows that Senator Sanders is outpacing others in the Democratic primary when it comes to donations from Obama, Trump voters. In other words, Senator Sanders has the message that will continue to broaden and attract more people to the Democratic Party. That's actually what we are supposed to be about. So again, if we are looking to defeat President Trump, if we are looking to unify this nation, and if we are looking to have a true champion who will go up against corruption and who will stand in the ready position for the everyday people of this nation, his name is Bernard Sanders.
Nina Turner, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And thank you all for independent TYT. Thank you, all your sisters and brothers in the independent media family. Thank you so much for giving the people of this country a different view and educating us and keeping it real at all times.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Everybody at home, stick around a little bit more after this. We turn now to a story of effectively the most tragic sort. Former Los Angeles Lakers player Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna died in a helicopter crash Sunday morning. The helicopter, which crashed in Calabasas, California, had at least 9 people on board. The LA County Sheriff's Department confirmed that there were no survivors. So far, Kobe, his daughter, and the pilot are the only individuals who've been identified, but 9 total victims. We're joined now by the host of TYT Sports, Rick Strom.
Hey.
We were talking during the break. This is just about as sad as any sports news that I can think of in recent years. Tell me, I saw on social media in real time as it was coming out, people didn't accept that it was even true. Mm-hmm. How did you feel as the news was developing?
Shocked. You know, it's like, it's one of those things where it doesn't feel real and you start thinking like, come on, like someone's just messing with us on Twitter. Like that's what you... It's what I thought, at least. Kobe was someone that, incredible basketball player, incredible human being. Like all of us, he was flawed. There is no perfect human being. What really struck me was he came to the Lakers at 17. Mm-hmm. He was the first kid to be drafted out of high school. Mm-hmm. And he succeeded in a market like Los Angeles. Like, where we are right now, we all know about this. Like, Los Angeles is built on breeding the next star, mm-hmm. right? And yet, Kobe was at 17, and when he finally decided to retire, and he dropped 60 points on his retirement game, his last game, he outdid all the stars in a town that is built upon them.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel real because... when you hear him speak during his playing career, retirement, he was a fighter. He fought for the WNBA. He fought for his baby girl Gianna, who perished at just 13. When he spoke with Kimmel, and I know we were talking about this, but you know, when people would come up to him and be like, you gotta have a boy, you gotta have a boy, she would interrupt whoever that was who would say that and be like, I got this, I'm gonna carry the torch. And if you watch any of her highlights, she was damn good.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Kobe was also like a mentor, a teacher, a friend. He felt like honestly, he felt like an uncle. And even though I never met him, I always wanted to meet him, I always wanted to interview him, because this next chapter of his life was literally being written. We were seeing it happen before our eyes from the mama.
He was so young.
He was so young. From the mama mentality book to Dear Basketball, winning an Oscar, his first time ever doing something like that. He took on his post-career as if it was his playing career with the element of competitiveness. Mm-hmm. And it is so sad because it was literally just starting.
Yeah. Yeah, and to how he was using his time, I want to read one quote. Mm-hmm. He said this: I have a life and I have my routine at home. It's not that I don't want to go to Lakers games, but I'd rather be giving baby a shower and sing Barney songs to her. I played 20 years and I missed those moments before. For me to take the trip up to Staples Center, that means I'm missing an opportunity to spend another night with my kids when I know how fast it goes. He was just 41. Like, she could have ended up in the WNBA. He was staying with her to help that happen. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I'm not a huge sports guy. You know, it means a different thing to other people than it means to me. But it's just, it's the saddest thing to possibly imagine. Like, we only know a few of the individuals, but for him, for his daughter especially, like, it's just brutal. Like, you hate this sort of story. It feels like the sort of thing that shouldn't be able to happen.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well put.
Well, as always, thank you for joining us. Really do appreciate it. Hopefully next time it'll be for happier news. And everybody at home, thank you so much for watching. We've got a gigantic week planned for you. We're gonna have J.R. Jackson a little bit. Brett Earl is gonna be joining me later in the week, and we do have some awesome guests planned. So, you know, stay tuned for that. If you haven't already, every morning before the show, we do live YouTube videos. So go to the YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedamagereport. See you tomorrow for those.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.